Thank you for tuning in to Emmanuel Faith Community Church. We hope you enjoy today's sermon.
Well, good morning, Emmanuel Faith. So good to see you. If you're joining us online, welcome to you also. I need to make sure that I have the right message downloaded in my mind and on my notes because we've had a few concerts over this weekend, and we've had three already and two more today, and we've had a great time. I would invite you, come out for one of those, 2 o'clock, 5 o'clock. If you've already come once and you want to come again, then come on, let's do this. It's going to be really, really fun, and would love to have you there. This last week, I was on a run over at Kit Carson Park, and I ran past Queen Califia's magic circle. And I thought to myself, man, that's weird. if you've been around Escondido, you know it well enough. It's probably not weird to you anymore. It's sort of strange. Let's be honest with each other. Like, when we first moved back to Escondido, Kelly and I were like, we should probably take the kids to Queen Califia's. And every time I say that, I want to say Queen Latifah's magic. I want to say Queen Latifah's magic carpet ride, but I won't. We went, and of course it was closed because it's open for like 10 minutes every week, right? We finally found a time when it was open, and you know, we went inside, and it's interesting, right? I mean, it's a mosaic, and it's art, and it's sort of cool and sort of funky, and you're like, I don't exactly know why this is in the middle of the park, and we're proud of it in Escondido. Like, there's signs on Bear Valley that tell people, for 10 minutes a week, this is open, and you can go see it. And here's the thing, like, I like art, you know? Kelly and I enjoy going to museums every once in a while, but I've got to be honest with you. Sometimes, like, I'll see people standing around and oohing and aahing, and I'm thinking in the back of my mind, ooh, I don't think I get it, you know? Like, I had a layover in Paris one time, and so it was a long layover, and we had the chance to get out and go to the Louvre. I was at the Louvre for 2 hours. I know, you shouldn't go to the Louvre. You should go to the Louvre for 2 days, not 2 hours. So I'm, like, walking around, and I'm like, oh, hey, there's the Mona Lisa. And I thought to myself, huh, it's smaller than I expected. Like, that was my thought. Like, this is one of the most famous art pieces in the world. And I snapped this picture of myself with the Mona Lisa. And I'm like, I don't know if I get it. I know I don't get it, right? And I think that's the way we feel sometimes when we're reading the Bible. We're like, I don't know if I get it. Like, there's something going on here that people seem excited about, but I'm not sure if I understand what it is. And there's parts of the Bible we read that are disorienting. There's parts of the Bible that we read that maybe even are a little bit disturbing. There's parts of the Bible we read and we sort of want to close it and go, not exactly sure what that's doing there. And this today that we're going to study in Ruth chapter 3 is sort of one of those passages. It reminded me of what the scholar John Walton said when he said, the Bible was written for us, but not to us. Like, we're reading somebody else's mail in so many ways, somebody else's story. So there's these layers of cultural nuance and things that were going on in Israel's world back in the time when this was written that don't happen the same way in our world. And so there's this, like, bridge that we need to build in between where we are and where they were so that we can understand what's going on. So if you'll allow me today, I sort of want to be like the docent at a museum that points out different things in this passage and goes, oh, this is so beautiful. We may not see it on the surface, but it's right there, right underneath. And I want to point it out to you so that you can get lit up about what's happening in Ruth chapter 3, because it is an amazing, amazing story. So as you're turning to Ruth 3 in your Bible, let me catch you up on where we've been over the last 2 weeks. Week one, we were introduced to Elimelech's family who left Bethlehem because of a famine and moved east to Moab, where Elimelech and his sons died. His wife Naomi was left with her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah Winfrey. And Orpah moved back to Moab, right? And Ruth and Naomi make this journey, 50 to 70 miles, back to Bethlehem. Naomi walks into Bethlehem a shell of who she was a decade earlier when she left to go find food with her husband in Moab. And Naomi, or Ruth, starts gleaning or scavenging in a field of a man named Boaz. We read about that last week. We were told in chapter 2, verse 1, that Boaz was a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. Tuck that away. That's going to be important as we journey through this passage together today. So Ruth is working in Boaz's field. Boaz keeps her close so that he can protect her. In fact, he says he keeps her close so that she wouldn't get abused by the other men. That was just the culture of the time. Listen to what it said at the very end of chapter 2, and this will launch us into chapter 3. It says, so she, Ruth, kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. So they entered back into Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. That was in roughly in March, and the end of the wheat harvest is in July. So you've had a number of months pass when Ruth and Boaz have been interacting with each other, at least in passing. And that's where we pick up in Ruth chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Are you there? Great, here we go. It says this, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, to Ruth, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So wash, therefore, and anoint yourself. Put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Now, a number of scholars point out that Naomi is telling Ruth to dress almost as a bride. And you could read it that way. In the least, what we should read is that Naomi is telling Ruth, hey, dress in a way that tells Boaz you're at least open and available. That if he's interested in taking this to the next level, so are you. Like your season of mourning is over, and now it's time to step into the future that God may have for you. This is a compassionate mother-in-law saying to her daughter-in-law, who's a widow, your life isn't over. God still has a good plan for you. God still has good in store. And so she encourages Ruth to step into the next chapter of her life. And in this chapter, what I want you to see is that Naomi is looking out for Ruth. That's the way it starts. She says that she wants her to find rest. Because here's what Naomi knows. Naomi knows that if she dies, when she's a lot older than Ruth, if she passes away, then Ruth is going to be a single widow who's foreign in a foreign land, and the only way that she would be taken care of is if she was married to somebody. So that was just the culture that they lived in, and so Naomi is encouraging Ruth, Ruth, go get married, and there's a guy that's been kind to you and protected you, and make sure he knows that if he's interested, so are you. But as we're going to see as we journey through this story, Naomi isn't the only one looking out for someone. Ruth is going to be looking out for Naomi. And as we'll see, Boaz is looking out for both Naomi and Ruth and, drumroll, Elimelech. And we have a word that we use for looking out for somebody else's interests. That word is love. It's love. We use that word quite flippantly in our culture, don't we? Like, I love burritos. I love the Denver Broncos. And I love my wife. And those are all very different loves, I assure you of that, right? We throw that word around so flippantly, but listen to the way the scriptures define that word love. Greater love has no one than this, that they lay down his life for his friends. How does the Bible describe and define love? It's to lay your life down for someone else. And in this story, you're going to see three people who are laying their lives down for the other people in the story. My guess is that you've heard the phrase, God helps those who help themselves. What verse is that again? All right, that's not in the scriptures. In fact, that's a quote that's often attributed to Ben Franklin. But I would suggest to you that the book of Ruth and the story of Scripture tells a very, very different story. God helps those who can't help themselves, and God often empowers others who want to help other people. Those are the kind of people that God comes alongside of. Because as we're going to see in this story, God's blessings often flow through human expressions of selfless love. To say it another way, God is looking for people who are willing to lay down their lives for others. And those people are people that God seems to pour his power and goodness and resources into so that they can be a blessing to other people. And that's exactly what we're going to see in Ruth chapter 3. God's blessings often flow through human expressions of selfless love. So Naomi tells Ruth, hey, go get dressed up, put on your makeup, get dressed as a bride, at least stop your mourning, and go and meet Boaz on the threshing floor. Here's the rest of the plan, verse 4. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, and then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. So you just need to picture it so that you have the setting in your mind. The setting of Ruth chapter 3 is a threshing floor near Bethlehem. And threshing floors were often in open areas outside of the city gates where farmers would come and they would process their grain. So they would either have an animal that sort of treaded down the grain, or they would use some sort of tool, wooden tool, to separate the grain from the stalks. And then they would take a winnowing fork and they would launch the grain up in the air so that the wind would come and blow the chaff away and the heavier grain would sink down onto the threshing floor. After they did that, they would go and celebrate the harvest that they just received. But because people were a little bit shady back then, they would have somebody go and sleep at the threshing floor so that nobody came and stole the grain before they could either store it or sell it to someone else. That's what's going on. But Naomi tells Ruth, hey, get dressed up, go uncover his feet and lay at the end of his bed. So I think we have to ask the question. What's going on? Like, is Naomi serving Ruth up on a sexual platter? Is Ruth being forward and doing something that would have been deemed inappropriate? I mean, let's at least ask the question. Are Naomi and Ruth ambushing Boaz? They say, wait until he's done partying, celebrating. He'll have had a little bit to drink and maybe his inhibitions will be a little bit low and you go lie at his feet and then let's just see what happens. I mean, what's the story here? I mean, if Boaz was going to make a move on Ruth, he had months to do it. Not only that, but let's peel back the social customs a little bit. Because in their day and their time, it was the custom of a father or a brother to go and meet with a family to broker a marriage between his daughter or sister and another man. And in this story, we don't have any of that going on. There's no man to speak for Ruth. There's no dowry to be given. There's no social connection or political power to be gained by marrying Ruth. I mean, Ruth just comes totally empty-handed with very, very little to offer. Ruth is going to propose to Boaz. Like, that didn't happen back in this day. In fact, I think that author and scholar Daniel Block put it so well when he said, Naomi's plan is fraught with danger. Her proposal of marriage was highly irregular from the standpoint of custom. A woman propositioning a man, a young person propositioning an older person, a destitute field worker propositioning a landowner. When you put it like that, which is what's actually going on, you realize that this is a tenuous situation that Ruth is stepping into. But man, you just got to see, Naomi is quite the strategist because she has positioned this to happen at such a time where if Boaz decides that he does not want to marry Ruth, they could both step away and neither of their reputations would be harmed. Nobody would have known what went on, and they could both go back to their lives as they were. So listen to the play-by-play of what happens. Verse 6. So Ruth went down to the threshing floor and did as her mother-in-law commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. You just got to imagine that Ruth is in the shadows trying to remain quiet. My guess is her heart is beating out of her chest, wondering how in the world all of this is going to play out. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Just time out right there. Before they're even married, Ruth is already stealing the covers from Boaz. My goodness. Come on, ladies. Give me that. At midnight, verse 8, at midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. Now, Boaz is a proper man, a worthy man, impeccable conduct, and he awakens in the middle of the night, and in the shadows, he sees a woman lying at his feet. It reminds me of when our kids were a little bit younger, and oftentimes, our kids would come into our room having been awoken by a dream or something at night that just disturbed them. Sometimes they come in and wake you up, your kids do. Other times, if they want to just terrify you, what they do is they just come and stare at you until you wake up and you're like, oh my goodness, like at least announce your entry. Like, that's the way I picture the scene, right? Is Boaz wakes up and goes, whoa, who are you? That's exactly what he'll ask next. Now, you just need to know, as we've already stated, the scene is sexually charged. It's sexually loaded. And the author wants to drive home the point that God's people are perpetually going to be confronted with difficult situations and hard choices. And the question we have to answer is, will we let our own lusts and our own self-interest guide us, or will we choose the way of love, looking for the best for the other? So once Boaz catches his breath, he says, who are you? I mean, it's just pitch darkness out in the countryside. Who are you? And she said, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a what? For you are a redeemer. Now, pop quiz. True or false? This is the plan that Naomi gave Ruth to execute. False. False. Here's the plan. He will tell you what to do. That was the plan. And Ruth is like, hey, Naomi, I see your plan. But I raise you a new, better plan. Remember, Naomi is looking out for Ruth, and Ruth is looking out for Naomi. So this is an ask, we're gonna see, that is filled with love, but it is, and love often demands this of us, it is risky boldness, what Ruth is asking of Boaz. She proposes to Boaz, but she asks for way more than his hand in marriage. I know it might not make sense right now. Right now, it might seem a little bit like Queen Califia's magic circle, okay? So let me just sort of take you through it and unpack what's going on. Ruth says two things. First, she said, spread your wings over your servant. I don't know if this sounds familiar to anyone else. If you were here last week, then it should at least pique a little bit of interest and go, like, I think I've heard that before, and you have. Because this is part of the prayer that Boaz prayed for Ruth in chapter 2. Listen to what he said. He said to Ruth, the Lord repay you for what you've done, and full reward given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So Boaz is like, man, Ruth, you've done an amazing thing in sticking with your mother-in-law, Naomi. May God show chesed and kindness to you while he protects you under his wings. And then Ruth says back to Boaz, Boaz, spread your wings over your servant. She's like, hey, Boaz, I think that God is asking you to be a part of the answer to the prayer that you're praying. And I would just say to you, friends, that God often asks us to be part of the answer to the prayers that we're praying. And I hope you have people in your life who don't know Jesus yet, and that you're praying that they would come to faith in him. And I hope that as you pray, you start to get this sense that maybe God would have you play a part in their story. That he would use your words or your invite to a Christmas concert, your invite to Christmas Eve, that he would use your invitation to pray for somebody as a part of the way that he brings about blessing and redemption in their life. I love that Ruth says, Boaz, you're praying for it, and now I'm inviting you to step into it. Not an accident that she uses his same word. Second, she says, for you are a, say it with me, church. You're a redeemer. In the Hebrew, it's the word goal. Would you say that with me? Goal. And it's translated in various ways. New Living translates it family redeemer. NIV is guardian family redeemer. And the NET version is guardian of family interest. See, each one puts this nuance of something's happening in a family unit because of this redeemer. But it quite literally means to buy back someone or something. When we think of the word redeemer, we often think of it in merely spiritual sense, right? Like we have a redeemer. His name is Jesus. He's purchased us out of the throes of sin and death and evil, and he has brought us into his marvelous light. We've been redeemed. Somebody say amen. But that isn't the way that an ancient Hebrew would have necessarily understood that word. They would have understood it in a far more materialistic, physical way. And when somebody used the word redeemer, two things would immediately come to mind, and two laws would be immediately triggered into effect. And it would stop the conversation right there. It's sort of like somebody who's being interrogated saying, I want to talk to a lawyer. Conversation over, new conversation is going to be had now. That's what happened when somebody would say, we need a redeemer. So two laws, and I want you to write these down because they're so important to the story, that Ruth enacts when she goes off script and asks Boaz to be their redeemer. First is the kinsman redeemer law. It's found in Leviticus chapter 25, and starting in verse 23, listen to the way that it reads. It says, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land, God says, is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem it. Go all. What his brother has sold. So next week you'll hear that chapter 4 seems to suggest that Naomi hasn't sold the land yet. They walked away from it a decade before. It's laid unharvested for probably a decade, overgrown. And this law ensured that the land stayed in the same family. But that's not the only law that's triggered by Ruth saying, be our redeemer. Here's the second law. It's called the levirate marriage law. And it's found in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And here's how it reads. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside of the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, shall sleep with her, and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Now, that's very detailed, a bit uncomfortable, and I was reading this law going, thank the Lord that I don't live back then. And that was number one. Number two, I bet brothers had a vested interest in who their other brothers married. Going like, can we talk about this one a little bit? Like, I'm just not quite sure. And how healthy are you feeling? Have you had a physical lately before you step into this marriage, right? Like, the levirate marriage provided for the continuation of a family line when a man died without a male heir. So both of these laws triggered into effect when Ruth says, be our redeemer. And both of those laws emphasize familial responsibility, social justice, and the care for vulnerable women in the Hebrew community. One law redeems family land, the other redeems family name, and Ruth triggers both of those laws when she asks Boaz to be their redeemer. Not what Naomi asked for. And I started to wonder why. And I wonder if Naomi's just worried about taking care of Ruth. I don't even know if she has a big enough vision to see that Elimelech's line could be redeemed. Like, I think for her, that dream has died. I think for her, that dream is over, that it got buried in Moab, and now it's just survival. To think about redemption is almost too hard to think about because it's so far outside of the picture of what could actually happen. I love the way that Carolyn Custis James put it in her brilliant book, The Gospel of Ruth. She said, now instead of a simple private transaction between two people and a marriage that could have been consummated that night, which seems to have been Naomi's expectation. They could have decided to get married that night, gotten married that night, and been together that night. This becomes a public legal matter with serious complications involving other parties. In a few words, Naomi's plan is overthrown and everything has changed. Because she has somebody in her life who can dream bigger than anything that she can see. And see, I'm pretty convinced that we all need people around us who believe that God can do more than we can see, who believe that God can work in our pain, who believe that God can work in the deaths that we experience, who believe that God can work in our lowest moments and bring about some of his brightest life. We need people who can hold up our arms when we're weary, who can hope for us when we're desperate. We need people like Ruth in our life who say, that's a great plan, but God can do way more. My God can do abundantly more than all that I could ask or think or dream or imagine. That's the role that Ruth plays. So back to the drama. What's going to happen? Is Boaz going to take advantage of Ruth? Is he going to dismiss her? Is the ask too big? Is it too much? Listen to the way it goes. Verse 10. And Boaz said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You've made this last kindness, or chesed, greater than the first, and you've not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. He's saying, you could have just taken care of yourself, made sure that number one was taken care of, but you haven't. You're still looking out for Naomi. Like you stood by her side and you walked with her those 50 to 70 miles back to Bethlehem, unsure of what you were gonna walk into, and that was certainly chesed, and that was certainly love, but now, you're putting yourself on the line to take care of her. And Boaz is like, man. Verse 11, now my daughter, do not fear, for I will do for you all that you ask, for all of my fellow townsmen know that you are a what? A worthy woman. Now, if you go back to verse 1 of chapter 2, you will see that the author describes Boaz as a worthy man. And now Boaz is like, oh, I've met my match. You are a strong, integritous woman, full of character, full of strength. See, I think sometimes that we live under this false illusion that if women are strong leaders, that men will automatically shrink into the background and go, well, if you're gonna lead strong, then guess I don't have a part here. I want you to see very clearly that that is not the narrative of the book of Ruth. Ruth is a worthy woman. Boaz is a worthy man. And they are stronger together, both of them strong together, than either one of them would be alone. See, Ruth's leadership inspires Boaz to new levels of leadership, love, and sacrifice. He doesn't shrink into the background. He steps onto the page to do what God's calling him to do. So by cover of darkness and the intimacy of a private moment, when Boaz and Ruth could have both cut corners, fast-tracked their marriage, and enjoyed each other's company, they didn't. They honor each other, and they honor God. You might even say that they love each other by not making love to each other. And they're painting this picture that's the foundation of selfless love, and it's this hidden integrity that just undergirds this entire story. Now, once again, let me act as the docent at the museum and just sort of point out what you're seeing. Because in the background of this story in Ruth chapter 2 is another story in our scriptures. It's another story about levirate marriage and kinsmen redeemers. And it happens in Genesis chapter 38. Now, if you do a read through the Bible in a year, you'll get to Genesis chapter 38 in the first few weeks of January. And my guess is you'll read Genesis chapter 38. And even if it's not the end of your reading for that day, you'll close your Bible, take a sip of your coffee, and wonder to yourself, what in the world am I supposed to do with that? Because here's a story in Genesis chapter 38. Judah was one of Jacob's 12 sons. He's Israelite royalty. Tamar, Judah's daughter-in-law, was widowed twice, married two of his sons. Levirate marriage, right? After the second son died, Judah promised his youngest son to Tamar. His name was Shelah. But he did not fulfill his obligation. He didn't give her his hand in marriage. In fact, the story suggests that Judah is a little bit superstitious that two of his sons have already died being married to her, and he didn't want to lose a third son. So he's like, yeah, I'll get to that when I get to that. Thank you very much, Tamar. And Tamar takes things into her own hands, and she goes and she dresses up like a prostitute at the city gate. Judah walks by her, takes her, sleeps with her, his daughter-in-law, doesn't know it's her, gets her pregnant, and she has twins. And at the end, I know it's one of those stories where you're like, really wish that wasn't in there. It is, it's just awkward. At the end of the story, Judah points at her and goes, how dare you get pregnant? You're not married. And Tamar looks back at him and goes, well, the kids are yours. And Judah's response is, you're more righteous than I am. So in one story, you have sin, deceit, and a woman who gets tossed around and taken advantage of. Same laws at play, levirate marriage, kinsman redeemer, and yet they weren't lived into. They weren't executed. You have that story dancing in the background of this story. And if you don't believe me that it's there, just flip over to Ruth chapter 4, verse 12, and you will see that the townspeople pray a blessing over Ruth, and they say, may you be like Tamar and Perez. Like, the author doesn't want us to miss it. It's right in the background. But this story is so much different than that story. Like, Boaz's hidden integrity shapes the trajectory of this whole story. Like, Boaz is not Judah. So Ruth doesn't have to be Tamar. What's really interesting to me is that the line of Jesus, the lineage of Jesus, runs through both of these families. I mean, Matthew chapter 1 recounts it for us. Matthew writes this: Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. He's talking about Jesus's lineage, Jesus's blood. See, last week we found out that Ruth's child with Boaz was also in the line of Christ. See, here's the deal, you guys. God will get redemption done one way or another. If he's got a plan, he will execute it. And he will weave his goodness even in the midst of sin and deceit and evil. He will get redemption done. But my goodness, you guys, it is so much more fun to be a part of God's plan when we live with integrity, when we live with faith, when we trust him. He gets it done through Judah and Tamar, and he gets it done through Ruth and Boaz. But my goodness, when we live in his way, with his heart, with obedience, we get to live the kind of story that we actually want to tell. Like, I'm guessing that Ruth and Boaz have no problem handing this story to their kids. Yeah, read it. Their grandkids, read it. I'm guessing Judah is like, if he could skip over 38, that'd be great. Either way, God gets redemption done. The question is, how much do you want to enjoy it? Listen to the way the scene ends. It says this, verse 12. And now it's true, I am a redeemer, yet there's a redeemer nearer than I. I mean, I don't know if you can hear it, but there are skids on the floor of that threshing floor. And Ruth's like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, there's a closer relative to Elimelech than me. And it's his duty to do what you're asking me to do. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good, let him do it. If he will not redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down till morning. How much sleep you think they got that night? Like, very little, very little. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. So it's still dark. And he said, let it not be known that a woman has come to the threshing floor. Not because he wants to necessarily keep it secret, but because he wants to protect her reputation. Everybody would have seen, that would have seen her walking out of that threshing floor, would have assumed something happened that didn't happen. And he said, bring me the garment that you're wearing and hold it out. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. And then she went into the city. Anyone want to guess how much 6 measures of barley weighs? 60 to 100 pounds. So just in case you have a picture of Ruth, where Ruth's like, you know, like all proper. No, this worthy woman is carrying 60 to 100 pounds back into the city of Bethlehem. I imagine Ruth being like, load me up, I can carry more, right? And there's this beautiful picture of the covenant not even being entered into. They're not married yet, and they don't know what's gonna happen. But Boaz is still just giving, giving, giving. Even if somebody else marries Ruth, he still sends her away full. I'm reminded of what Desmond Tutu said. He said, do your little bit of good where you are. It's those little bits of good put together that overwhelm the world. Those little acts of love that add up and eventually overturn everything. See, this story is chock full of selfless love. We see it in bold risk. We see it in hidden integrity. And we see it in Boaz's quiet generosity. Not knowing what's going to happen, he sends Ruth back full. I love it. So by cover of morning, Ruth returns home to see Naomi. And listen to the way the interchange goes. It says, and when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Are you married? Did he say yes? Did you execute my plan? And I imagine that Ruth is like, hey, funny story, I decided to add in a few things. Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And she replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. You got to come back next week to hear how it ends. But I just want you to see in this chapter, in this book, that you have Naomi looking out for Ruth, Ruth looking out for Naomi, and Boaz is looking out for Naomi and Ruth and Elimelech. And we call this love. And God's blessings often flow through human, through your expressions of selfless love in your family, at your workplace, in your neighborhood. That's the way his blessing often flows, as far as the curse is found. And maybe it shouldn't surprise us that this story takes place in Bethlehem, because it points to another story that took place in Bethlehem around 1,000 years later. Another story that has at its core selfless love. In that version, it's not Ruth and Boaz. It's Mary and Joseph laying their baby Jesus down in a, what? In a manger. And a manger was a feeding trough. And a feeding trough would have had what in it? Grain. Grain. So you have this echo back to 1,000 years earlier when Ruth and Boaz are on a threshing floor covered with grain, and they both act with selfless love. Fast forward 1,000 years, you have the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. The God who created everything you see around you and calls out each star by name. He is powerful beyond your imagination, clothed in human flesh, lying down on a pile of grain as a declaration of selfless love for you, because he came to your rescue, because you too needed a redeemer. You couldn't do it, just like Ruth and Naomi, you couldn't do it on yourself, so for yourself. So God steps into the story that he is telling. And he says to you and to me, come, come, find shelter, find protection, find covering, find healing, find love underneath my wings. See, Ruth is the story of God's redemption. One family that points us to the redemption of all humanity through Jesus. The ingenuity of Naomi, the boldness of Ruth, levirate marriage and kinsman redeemer laws at work, the integrity of Boaz and Ruth, and the sacrifice of Boaz, and through it all, God weaves together his mosaic of redemption. A mosaic. That's what it is. You go to Queen Califia's magic circle and you walk around, and what you see are all of these broken pieces put together to build something really, really strange, but also pretty beautiful. And it's the exact same way that God works in our life. He takes these broken pieces, and by his goodness and his grace, he puts them together to build his masterpiece. See, God redeems the shattered pieces of our lives, and he turns them into displays of his amazing, abundant, never-ending grace. So, where do you need that God to work in your life today? Ask him. And then what might it look like for you to take one small step of love that God might channel his blessing through in a way that invites other people to come under his wings and to find the redemption that their souls long for. So Jesus, thank you for emptying yourself of all that it means to be God, coming to live among us, being found in the form of human flesh, giving yourself for us. Lord, during this Advent season, would we remember the redemption that we were in desperate need of? And would you remind us of the way that you have fully satisfied every need that we have? It's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to our service. We'd love to have you join us in person. For more information about our church and service times, please visit efcc.org. If you would like to support the ministries of Emmanuel Faith, you can do so at efcc.org/give.